Here is a detailed podcast episode transcript about the research paper Understanding Intra-Household Educational Inequalities, Gender, Birth Order, and Ability Dynamics in Benin's Households, less than intro greater than. Hello and welcome to the award-winning podcast that investigates the latest research with depth and intrigue. I'm Tom, and joining me as always is my co-host, Jen.
Hi there. Today we're diving into a fascinating paper that explores the complex interplay of gender, birth order, and innate ability in shaping educational inequalities within households. The title of this study is Understanding Intra-Household Educational Inequalities, Gender, Birth Order, and Ability Dynamics in Benin's Households.
This paper takes us to the West African nation of Benin, where the researchers unpack the nuanced factors contributing to disparities in educational attainment among children from the same family. Their findings offer valuable insights that could inform more targeted policies to promote educational equity.
It's a rich and thought-provoking study, Tom. The researchers don't just identify the sources of inequality. They also examine how these different factors interact with one another to drive the observed educational gaps within households. This kind of comprehensive analysis is crucial for designing effective interventions.
Absolutely. Let's dive in and learn more about this groundbreaking research. Less than, intro greater than, less than, body greater than. The core research question at the heart of this paper is, what are the relative contributions of gender, birth order, and innate ability in driving educational inequalities among children within the same household?
That's a really important question, especially in a context like Benin, where there's no universal compulsory education law. This means parents have a lot of discretion in how they allocate their limited educational resources among their children.
Exactly. The researchers recognize that the traditional economic models of the quantity-quality trade-off in fertility decisions don't fully capture the nuances at play here. Simply looking at the average quality of children within a household misses the crucial dynamics happening at the individual level.
That's a great point. The researchers wanted to go beyond just examining the overall inequality between households. They aimed to understand the sources of variation in educational attainment among the children within the same household.
To do this, the researchers employed both a reduced form analysis and a structural model of household resource allocation. By decomposing the overall disparities, they were able to identify the distinct contributions of gender, birth order, and innate ability differences.
That's a really clever approach. So, what did they find in the context of Benin?
Well, the results paint a fascinating picture. For households with non-educated heads and mixed gender children, the researchers found that total inequality comprised 50% gender disparity, 20% birth order effect, and 30% ability gap.
Wow, that's a significant gender disadvantage. I can imagine that would have serious implications for educational and social mobility, especially for girls in those households.
Absolutely. But interestingly, the story changes when we look at households with only sons or only daughters and non-educated heads. In those cases, the total inequality was predominantly driven by ability disparities, 70% for daughters and 83% for sons, with lesser contributions from birth order effects.
That's a really fascinating finding. It suggests that in some households, the gender disadvantage actually reduces the extent to which a child's innate talent affects their educational outcomes. This implies that simply removing gender and birth order biases may not systematically reduce inequality across all households.
Right. It's a nuanced and complex dynamic. The researchers also found that in households with non-educated heads, firstborn daughters can surpass their younger brothers in educational attainment if their innate ability exceeds their brothers by at least 13%. But that figure drops to 8% in households with college-educated parents.
Ah, so parental education level seems to play a crucial role as well. The more educated parents appear to be less biased against daughters in terms of educational investment decisions.
Exactly. The analysis reveals that non-educated parents perceive a 22% higher average benefit from investing in their son's education compared to their daughters. But this gap is much smaller for college-educated parents.
That's a really important insight. It suggests that targeted policies aimed at reducing the composite costs of education could be effective in mitigating gender and birth order gaps, though the impact may be modest, around a 5% reduction in total inequality.
Right, and the researchers highlight this as a tricky balance to strike. On one hand, you want to ensure equal educational opportunities regardless of gender, birth order, or ability. but on the other hand, you also want to reward high abilities while not penalizing gender and birth order.
That's a great point. It's a delicate equilibrium, and the researcher's analysis provides valuable guidance on navigating these complexities. This is such a rich and nuanced study. I'm really impressed by the depth of their findings.
Me too. They've really shed light on the intricate dynamics at play within households when it comes to educational investment decisions. It's a level of granularity that we don't often see in this type of research. Less than, body greater than, less than, reflections greater than.
As we reflect on this study, I'm struck by how well the researchers have captured the real-world challenges facing families in Benin. The trade-offs and constraints they navigate when allocating scarce educational resources are so important to understand.
Absolutely. One of the things I find most compelling is the way they've managed to disentangle the relative contributions of gender, birth order, and ability. That level of analytical rigor is really valuable for informing policy interventions.
I agree. And I think their willingness to acknowledge the limitations of their approach, like the potential for unobserved factors to influence the ability component, demonstrates a refreshing humility and nuance.
Definitely. They've recognized the complex realities at play and avoided oversimplifying the issues. That's crucial when dealing with something as multifaceted as educational inequality within households.
Absolutely. And I think their findings around the potential unintended consequences of certain policy approaches, like non-targeted increases in educational resources, are really important cautionary tales. It shows the need for very targeted, context-specific interventions.
Exactly. This research highlights just how crucial it is to understand the underlying dynamics at a granular level before implementing sweeping changes. Small tweaks can have outsized impacts, both positive and negative.
Agreed. Overall, I think this is an exemplary piece of research that does an excellent job of illuminating a complex issue and offering nuanced insights to guide future policy decisions. It's the kind of work that can truly make a difference in people's lives.
Couldn't have said it better myself, Jen. This is the kind of deep, rigorous analysis that we love to showcase on this podcast. It's a testament to the power of social science research to uncover hidden truths and inform meaningful change. Less than, reflections greater than, less than, conclusion greater than. To summarize the key takeaways from this remarkable study, in Benin, the overall inequality in children's educational attainment within households is driven by a complex interplay of gender bias, birth order effects, and disparities in innate abilities. The relative contributions of these factors vary significantly depending on the household context, particularly the educational background of the parents. Targeted policies that reduce the composite costs of education for firstborn children and daughters can help mitigate gender and birth order gaps, but the impact may be modest. Ultimately, this research underscores the need for nuanced, context-specific interventions that carefully balance the objectives of promoting equal opportunities and rewarding high abilities.
Absolutely, Tom. This is the kind of work that challenges us to think beyond simplistic solutions and embrace the full complexity of the issues at hand. It's a powerful reminder that progress on educational equity requires a deep understanding of the multifaceted dynamics shaping outcomes within households.
Well said, Jen. This study sets a high bar for rigorous, impactful social science research. It's been a pleasure diving into this fascinating paper with you today. I'm sure our listeners have gained valuable insights that will stay with them long after this episode.
Absolutely. Thank you all for joining us, and we look forward to exploring more cutting-edge discoveries in the episodes to come. Until next time, keep learning and keep questioning.
Take care, everyone. Less than, conclusion greater than. Here is a funny, weird, and concise commercial for a company that exists as a result of the research paper Understanding Intra-Household Educational Inequalities, Gender, Birth Order, and Ability Dynamics in Benin's Households, less than commercial greater than. Are you a household in Benin struggling with educational inequalities between your children? Do you find yourself constantly favoring your firstborn son over your younger daughter, despite her superior innate abilities? Well, have we got the solution for you?
Introducing Ability Amulets, the revolutionary new product that harnesses the mystical powers of Benin's ancient traditions to even out the playing field for your children's education.
Simply have your firstborn daughter wear one of our handcrafted amulets and watch as her innate abilities are magically amplified, allowing her to outshine her brothers no matter their birth order.
But that's not all. Our amulets also come equipped with a special gender reversal charm, which temporarily switches your children's perceived value in your eyes, ensuring fair and equitable educational investments for all.
Ability Amulets, the mystical solution to your household's educational woes. Get yours today at the low price of 3 goats and a rare Beninese beetle. Quantities are limited, so don't delay.
Ability Amulets, leveling the playing field, one amulet at a time. Less than, commercial greater than.
Here is the full podcast episode transcript. Welcome to the award-winning podcast where we investigate cutting-edge research with intrigue and depth. I'm Tom, and joining me as always is my co-host Jen.
Hello listeners. Today we're excited to dive into a fascinating new paper that explores the critical role of hydrogen storage in Europe's transition to a carbon-neutral energy system. The paper is titled Quantifying Seasonal Hydrogen Storage Demands Under Cost and Market Uptake Uncertainties in Energy System Transformation Pathways.
This is such an important topic as the world races to decarbonize and hydrogen emerges as a key clean energy solution. The researchers set out to understand how uncertainties around hydrogen storage costs and market growth rates could impact the development of hydrogen infrastructure in Europe over the coming decades.
Absolutely. The researchers used a sophisticated modeling approach that linked a pan-European energy system planning model with a detailed gas infrastructure and market optimization framework. This allowed them to explore the intricate interactions between the electricity, gas, and hydrogen sectors as Europe transforms its energy system.
One of the key findings is just how crucial hydrogen storage will be for providing energy security and balancing supply and demand in a renewable-heavy system. The researchers ran scenarios with a wide range of potential hydrogen storage costs, from very low to extremely high. And they found that the storage cost assumptions had a major impact on the final hydrogen infrastructure configuration in 2050.
That's fascinating. So the hydrogen storage costs really seem to be a critical uncertainty that will shape Europe's energy future. But the researchers also looked at another key factor, market growth restrictions. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, this was a really insightful part of the analysis. The researchers explored different scenarios with varying degrees of constraints on how quickly the hydrogen market and infrastructure could grow over time. And they found that these market uptake restrictions had a big influence on the interim development of hydrogen storage, even if the final 2050 system ended up looking similar.
I see, so the storage cost assumptions drove the ultimate hydrogen system design, but the market growth rates were crucial in determining the transition pathway to get there. That's a really important distinction.
Exactly. The researchers highlight how policymakers and system planners need to carefully consider both of these uncertainties when charting the course for hydrogen's role in the energy transition. Getting the timing and scale of hydrogen infrastructure built out right is absolutely critical.
And it's not just about the final state of the energy system in 2050, the pathway matters a lot too, in terms of things like energy security, economic impacts, and social acceptance. This is a great example of how complex and multifaceted these energy transition challenges are.
Absolutely. The study also emphasized the key role of repurposing existing natural gas infrastructure for hydrogen use. Across all their scenarios, the researchers found that a large portion of the hydrogen pipelines and storage facilities were created by retrofitting and converting methane infrastructure. This helps minimize costs and disruption.
That's a really smart approach. Leveraging existing assets where possible is crucial for making this transition feasible and affordable. At the same time, the researchers highlight that there are limits to how much natural gas infrastructure can be reused, especially in some countries like the UK where methane demand persists.
Right, and that variability across different European countries and regions is another important insight. The researchers found that hydrogen storage needs were particularly sensitive to the assumptions in key transit hubs and major consumer markets like Germany. So a one-size-fits-all approach won't work. Policymakers will need to tailor strategies to local conditions.
That makes a lot of sense. Managing the complexity of this transition across the diverse European energy landscape is no easy feat. But studies like this one are so valuable for illuminating the key drivers and trade-offs involved.
Absolutely. And the researchers don't shy away from acknowledging the limitations of their modeling approach. They note that simplifications around gas network representation and temporal resolution could impact the precise storage demand projections. But the overall insights around the critical role of storage costs and market uptake remain robust.
That's a great point. No model can perfectly capture reality, but this study provides a rigorous and insightful framework for grappling with these crucial uncertainties. The researchers have made an important contribution to our understanding of hydrogen's place in Europe's decarbonization efforts.
I agree. This is the kind of research that can really shape the decisions of policymakers, industry leaders, and system planners as they work to build the infrastructure for a sustainable energy future. By quantifying the impacts of key uncertainties, the researchers are arming decision makers with the knowledge they need.
Absolutely. And the implications extend well beyond Europe as well. Many other regions around the world will be facing similar challenges in integrating hydrogen into their energy systems. This study serves as a valuable case study and model for how to approach those complex decisions.
Well said. This has been a fascinating dive into an important and timely piece of research. As always, we encourage our listeners to read the full paper and explore the topic further. There's so much more that could be unpacked here.
Definitely. This is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the role of hydrogen in the energy transition. But studies like this one are crucial for guiding us towards a clean, secure, and sustainable energy future. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.
Take care, everyone. Jingle plays. Are you tired of the uncertainty surrounding your hydrogen storage needs?
Introducing Hydrogen Hoard, your one-stop shop for all your seasonal energy storage solutions.
With Hydrogen Hoard, you'll never have to worry about those pesky hydrogen market growth rates or storage cost fluctuations again.
Our patented Hydrogen Hoard technology allows us to seamlessly integrate with your existing natural gas infrastructure, converting it to clean, green hydrogen storage in a snap.
No more headaches, no more guesswork, just reliable, on-demand hydrogen whenever you need it. That's the power of Hydrogen Hoard.
So what are you waiting for? Call 1-800-HOARD-IT today and let Hydrogen Hoard take the uncertainty out of your energy future.
Hydrogen Hoard. Storing energy. Securing your tomorrow. Asterisk jingle plays. Here is the podcast episode transcript. Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the latest groundbreaking research. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. Today, we're excited to explore a fascinating paper on sustainable regional economic development and land use in Russia.
The title of the paper is Sustainable Regional Economic Development and Land Use, a Case of Russia, and it's authored by Vadim Stryalkovsky, Oksana Mukorianova, Oksana Kuznetsova, and Yuri Sarov.
This paper really gets to the heart of a critical challenge facing Russia, balancing economic growth with environmental sustainability across its vast and diverse regions. The researchers paint a comprehensive picture of the strategies, strengths, and weaknesses involved in maximizing Russia's natural resources through sustainable land use practices.
That's right, Jen. Russia is a country blessed with an abundance of natural resources, from its sprawling forests to its fertile agricultural lands. But harnessing these resources in a sustainable way has proven to be a complex task, requiring careful integration of economic development and ecological conservation.
The paper highlights how Russia is navigating this delicate balance. On one hand, the country has embarked on major economic reforms since the fall of the Soviet Union, including the privatization and decentralization of land ownership. This was intended to boost agricultural productivity and spur regional development.
But as the researchers explain, this transition has also brought new challenges, like uneven distribution of land resources, unclear property rights, and underinvestment in rural infrastructure. Effectively managing all of that has been quite the uphill battle.
Absolutely. The paper takes us through the various strategies Russia is employing to maximize its land resources in a sustainable way. We're talking about things like precision agriculture, agroforestry, sustainable forestry practices, and innovative urban planning.
These strategies aim to boost economic productivity while minimizing environmental impacts. For example, precision farming uses advanced technologies to ensure crops get exactly what they need, reducing waste and preserving soil health. And agroforestry combines agriculture and forestry to create more diverse, resilient land use systems.
The researchers also highlight the critical role of policy reforms in aligning economic incentives with sustainability goals. Things like regulations limiting harmful industrial practices, taxes on carbon emissions, and financial incentives for green technologies. But as the paper points out, successful implementation requires coordination across different levels of government and active engagement with local communities.
That's a really important point, Jen. Top-down policies alone won't cut it. The paper emphasizes that empowering local residents to manage their own resources is essential for ensuring sustainable development aligns with regional needs and conditions.
Exactly. This is a complex, multifaceted challenge that demands an integrated approach. It's not just about implementing the latest green technologies or passing new environmental laws. It's about fostering a cultural shift where economic prosperity and ecological stewardship go hand in hand.
And the researchers make a strong case that getting this right is absolutely vital for Russia's future. With climate change posing grave threats to the country's ecosystems, from the vast taiga forests to the fragile Arctic regions, sustainable land use is no longer just an option, it's an urgent necessity.
Absolutely. This paper really drives home the point that Russia's regional economies can't thrive in the long run without a dramatic rethinking of how the country uses and manages its land. It's about finding that sweet spot between development and conservation, and doing it in a way that empowers communities and harnesses the latest innovations.
You know, what struck me most about this paper is the sheer scale and complexity of the challenge Russia faces. I mean, we're talking about a country that spans 11 time zones and encompasses everything from dense urban centers to remote wilderness. Coordinating a cohesive, sustainable land use strategy across all of that must be an absolutely daunting task.
Absolutely. But the researchers seem to have a pretty clear-eyed view of the obstacles. They acknowledge the tensions between economic growth and ecological protection, the need to balance top-down policies with bottom-up engagement, and the critical role of technological innovation alongside traditional knowledge.
And what I found really interesting is how they dive into the specific strategies and their respective strengths and weaknesses. Like, precision agriculture sounds great in theory, but the paper points out the high upfront costs and technical expertise required. Or how agroforestry can boost productivity and diversity, but may be limited by regional climate and terrain.
It's a really nuanced analysis, isn't it? The researchers aren't just presenting a utopian vision of sustainability, they're grappling with the real-world trade-offs and implementation challenges. And that, to me, makes the insights all the more valuable.
Totally agree. And the paper doesn't just stop at identifying the problems, it also offers some really compelling policy recommendations. Things like improving access to digital land management technologies, investing in skills training, and incentivizing economic diversification beyond resource extraction.
Absolutely. And the key thread running through all of those recommendations is the need for coordination and collaboration, across government levels, between urban and rural areas, and between policymakers, businesses, and local communities.
You know, as I was reading this paper, I couldn't help but think about the relevance of Russia's experience for other countries grappling with similar sustainability challenges. I mean, the scale and complexity of Russia's land use issues are pretty unique, but the core principles around balancing economic and ecological priorities, that's a universal struggle.
That's a great point, Tom. I think there's a lot that other nations, both developed and developing, could learn from Russia's successes and failures in this space. Things like the importance of technological innovations, the pitfalls of top-down policymaking, and the critical role of community engagement.
Exactly. And by studying Russia's journey, we might also uncover some innovative, context-specific solutions that could be adapted and applied elsewhere. After all, every country has its own unique environmental, economic, and cultural factors at play.
Absolutely. This paper really highlights the fact that there's no one-size-fits-all approach to sustainable land use and regional development. It's a highly complex challenge that requires a deep understanding of local nuances and a willingness to experiment with tailored strategies.
Well said, Jen. This has been a fascinating dive into a crucial issue facing Russia and the world at large. The researchers have done an excellent job of illuminating the multifaceted nature of sustainable land use, while also offering a clear-eyed assessment of the challenges and potential pathways forward.
Couldn't agree more, Tom. This paper is a prime example of the kind of cutting-edge, interdisciplinary research we love to explore on this podcast. By blending expert analysis with engaging storytelling, the authors have brought a complex topic to life in a way that's both informative and thought-provoking.
Absolutely. And I think the key takeaway here is that achieving sustainable regional development is not just about implementing the latest green technologies or passing new environmental laws. It's about fostering a fundamental shift in mindset, where economic prosperity and ecological stewardship are seen as interdependent, rather than competing, priorities.
Perfectly said, Tom. Russia's journey in this space serves as a powerful case study, reminding us that the path to a sustainable future requires vision, collaboration, and a deep commitment to balancing the needs of people and the planet. It's a challenge that extends far beyond Russia's borders, and one that we'll no doubt continue to grapple with for years to come.
Well said, Jen. This has been a fascinating exploration of a critical issue, and I'm sure our listeners have gained valuable insights that they can apply in their own communities and contexts. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone. Until next time, keep exploring the frontiers of research with us.
Are you tired of your land sitting around, doing nothing but growing weeds and housing the occasional family of raccoons?
Introducing Ecopreneur, the one-stop shop for all your sustainable regional development needs.
Ecopreneur harnesses the power of precision agriculture, agroforestry, and urban planning to transform your unused land into a veritable oasis of productivity and environmental harmony.
That's right, folks. Our team of expert eco-consultants will work with you to develop a customized land use plan that maximizes your property's economic potential while minimizing its ecological footprint.
Want to grow the freshest, most nutrient-dense produce this side of the Urals? Our precision farming tech will have your crops singing like a babushka in a borscht factory.
Or maybe you're dreaming of a lush, carbon-sequestering forest, complete with delicious edible berries and a herd of photogenic reindeer? Ecopreneur can make that happen, Tavarish.
And for you city slickers, we've got urban planning solutions that'll have your concrete jungle looking greener than Ivan Drago's gymnastics leotard.
So what are you waiting for? Call Ecopreneur today and let us turn your land into a sustainable oasis of prosperity. Operators are standing by, comrades.
Ecopreneur, where ecology meets economy, and the babushkas rejoice. Here is an informative, entertaining, and detailed podcast episode about the research paper Income Shocks and Their Transmission into Consumption. Intro. Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into cutting-edge research and unpack the latest discoveries with expert insight and engaging storytelling. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. Today, we're excited to discuss a fascinating paper that examines how household consumption responds to income shocks. The title of the paper is Income Shocks and Their Transmission into Consumption.
This paper, written by economists Edmund Crawley and Alexandros Feloudis, investigates a critical question for understanding how families cope with financial ups and downs, how policymakers can design effective safety nets, and how the broader economy is shaped by changes in consumer spending.
That's right, Tom. The researchers set out to measure just how much household consumption fluctuates in response to different types of income shocks, whether they're temporary setbacks or more permanent changes to a family's financial situation. Their findings offer important insights that could inform everything from social welfare programs to macroeconomic policy.
So let's jump right in. What did Crawley and Feloudis discover about the transmission of income shocks into household consumption, body?
The core of this paper is exploring three broad approaches that economists use to estimate the consumption response to income shocks. The first is structural modeling, where the researchers build a fully specified economic model to identify how shocks get passed through to spending.
Ah yes, the structural modeling approach. This involves laying out all the details of household decision-making, things like preferences, expectations, and budget constraints. Then the researchers use that framework to derive testable predictions about how consumption should respond to different income changes.
Exactly. One of the foundational studies in this area is a 2008 paper by Blundell, Pistifferi, and Preston. They developed a way to use the observed covariance between consumption growth and income growth to back out the degree of partial insurance that households have against permanent versus transitory income shocks.
Right. The key insight there is that the extent to which consumption tracks income reflects how much of an income shock gets transmitted into spending. If consumption is insulated from income changes, that implies households have found ways to smooth those shocks.
The Blundell et al. Study found that permanent income shocks have a much larger impact on consumption than transitory shocks. Specifically, they estimated that households only reduce their consumption by about 64% of a permanent income shock, meaning they are able to partially insure against those changes.
But for transitory shocks, the story was quite different. Blundell and his co-authors found that consumption is essentially unaffected. Households are able to fully insure against those temporary income fluctuations.
That's a really interesting result. It suggests that households have access to some mechanisms, like saving and borrowing, that allow them to ride out short-term income dips without having to cut back on spending.
Exactly. And subsequent studies building on this covariance approach have found a lot of nuance and heterogeneity in those insurance mechanisms. Some researchers have allowed for more flexibility in the income process, like accounting for asymmetric impacts of good versus bad shocks. Others have incorporated richer models of household behavior, like endogenous labor supply decisions.
That's a great point. As the structural modeling literature has evolved, the researchers have been able to unpack the different channels through which households can insulate their consumption. Things like access to credit, public assistance programs, and family labor supply have all been shown to play a role.
But even with all that progress, the structural modeling papers still have some limitations. They make assumptions about the underlying economic environment, and their conclusions depend quite a bit on the specifics of that framework.
That's where the natural experiment studies come in. This second broad approach tries to sidestep those modeling assumptions by looking at real-world situations where households experience exogenous income shocks.
Right. The classic example is the economic stimulus payments that were distributed to U.S. households during the 2000s. Researchers can compare the spending behavior of recipients to a control group that didn't get the extra cash.
Exactly. These natural experiment studies tend to focus more on estimating the marginal propensity to consume, or MPC, rather than the partial insurance parameters from the structural models. The idea is to directly measure how much of an income windfall gets spent.
And the natural experiment evidence generally points to MPCs that are higher than what the structural models suggest. For example, some of the studies on the U.S. stimulus payments found that households spent 50-90% of those lump sum transfers within just a few months.
That's a really striking difference. It suggests that the consumption smoothing mechanisms captured in the structural models may not tell the whole story. There could be factors, like liquidity constraints or behavioral biases, that lead households to spend windfalls more aggressively than predicted.
Absolutely. The natural experiment literature has also shed light on important heterogeneity in MPCs. Things like the size of the income shock, a household's existing level of liquid assets, and even demographics like age and gender have all been shown to influence how much of an extra dollar gets spent versus saved.
That's a great point. Understanding this kind of nuance is crucial, both for policymakers designing effective stimulus programs and for macroeconomists building realistic models of household behavior.
And the third broad approach that Crawley and Feludis discuss is the use of survey elicitation. Rather than inferring consumption responses from data on actual spending, some researchers have simply asked households directly how they would react to hypothetical income changes.
That's an intriguing method. By going straight to the source and getting people's self-reported expectations, these studies can complement the insights from the other two approaches.
Exactly. The survey evidence has uncovered some interesting patterns, like an asymmetry where households say they would cut spending more in response to an income loss versus an income gain of the same size.
That's a really fascinating finding. It suggests that the psychology of gains versus losses could be an important factor shaping consumption behavior that the more traditional economic models might miss.
Absolutely. And the survey studies have also been able to delve into how household spending plans evolve over time in response to news about future income changes. That dynamic aspect is harder to capture in the one-time natural experiments.
It's remarkable how this literature has leveraged these three distinct methodological approaches, structural modeling, natural experiments, and survey elicitation, to build a rich, multifaceted understanding of how income shocks transmit into household consumption. Each approach has its own strengths and limitations, but together they paint a nuanced and compelling picture. Reflections.
I have to say, I'm really impressed by the depth and breadth of this research. As an economist, I find it fascinating to see how the field has evolved, with researchers constantly pushing the boundaries to better understand this critical link between income and spending.
Absolutely. And I think what's so compelling about this work is the real-world relevance. Understanding household coping mechanisms has huge implications, from informing social safety net policies to predicting the macroeconomic impact of economic shocks.
Exactly. I was struck by how the findings could shed light on everything from the design of unemployment insurance to the transmission of monetary policy through the consumer sector. This isn't just academic theorizing, it's fundamental to how our economy functions.
I agree, and I found it intriguing how the research uncovered so much heterogeneity in consumption responses. The fact that factors like liquid assets, demographics, and even psychology can play such a big role really shows the importance of going beyond simplistic models.
Definitely. It reminds me that economic behavior is complex and multifaceted. There's no one-size-fits-all explanation. The researchers here have done an impressive job of trying to capture that nuance and unpack the various channels at play.
Absolutely. And I think what's so valuable about this body of work is that it doesn't just settle for easy answers. The researchers seem genuinely committed to advancing our understanding, even when that means grappling with contradictory findings or the limitations of their own methods.
That's a great point. Science is rarely a straight line to the truth. It's a messy, iterative process. And I really admire how these economists have embraced that, using multiple approaches to continually refine and deepen our knowledge.
Definitely. This paper is a perfect example of how rigorous, careful research can unlock important insights, even on a topic as fundamental as how households respond to income changes. It's a great reminder of the power of social science to illuminate the world around us. Conclusion.
Well said, Jen. In summary, this paper by Crawley and Feludis offers a comprehensive review of the latest research on the transmission of income shocks into household consumption. Through structural modeling, natural experiments, and survey elicitation, the literature has painted a rich, nuanced picture of this crucial economic relationship.
The key takeaways are that households are able to partially insure against permanent income shocks, but tend to spend more aggressively in response to transitory changes or windfall gains. And the extent of this consumption response varies widely based on factors like liquidity, demographics, and even psychology.
Absolutely. This research has major implications, from informing social welfare policies to enhancing our understanding of macroeconomic dynamics. It's a powerful example of how rigorous, multifaceted social science can shed light on the complex realities of human behavior and decision making.
Couldn't agree more, Tom. This has been a fascinating deep dive into cutting-edge research that truly brings the science to life. I'm sure our listeners are as intrigued as we are by the insights uncovered in this paper on income shocks and their transmission into consumption.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Jen. Thanks for joining me for another illuminating episode. We'll see you next time as we explore more groundbreaking discoveries at the intersection of research and real-world impact.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Until next time, keep exploring.
Funky jingle plays. Are you tired of income shocks causing chaos in your household budget?
Introducing Shockproof Savings, the revolutionary new financial product that insulates your consumption from those pesky income fluctuations.
With Shockproof Savings, you can ride out temporary income dips without having to cut back on your spending.
That's right, Tom. Our patent-pending technology automatically siphons off a portion of your paychecks into a special shock-resistant account.
So when the unexpected happens, whether it's a bonus, a layoff, or anything in between, your spending stays rock solid.
No more emotional roller coasters of joy and panic as your income bounces around. Shockproof Savings keeps your consumption as smooth and stable as a freshly waxed jungle survival machete.
And to help you really weather any storm, we include a free machete with every Shockproof account. Because you never know when you might need to hack your way through the financial undergrowth.
So don't let income shocks rattle your household. Get Shockproof Savings and start living that perfectly insulated lifestyle. Visit shockproofsavings.com to open your account today. Funky jingle fades out.
Here is the detailed podcast episode transcript. Hello and welcome to the Research Rundown, the podcast that takes you on a journey through cutting-edge scientific discoveries. I'm Tom, your host.
And I'm Jen, excited to dive into another fascinating research paper with you all today. This episode, we're exploring a study that examines how investor sentiment impacts trading behaviors in the Chinese stock market.
The paper is titled Internet Sentiment Exacerbates Intraday Overtrading, Evidence from a Share Market, and it was authored by Peng Yifeng from the Chinese University of Hong Kong.
This is a really intriguing study that gets to the heart of some crucial questions about investor psychology and market efficiency. The main finding is that fluctuations in online investor sentiment have a significant positive impact on excessive trading activity in the Chinese A-share market.
Exactly. The researchers found that when investor sentiment on social media platforms like the Eastmoney Forum Guba becomes more optimistic or pessimistic, it tends to drive a surge in short-term, excessive trading behaviors. And interestingly, this effect is even more pronounced for institutional investors compared to individual retail traders.
That's a really fascinating result. It suggests that even professional, supposedly rational investors can get caught up in the emotional swings of the market and let their decision-making be unduly influenced by the collective mood on online forums.
Right. The paper proposes that this is due to information asymmetries. Institutional investors have faster access to market data and can react more quickly to sentiment shifts, leading them to overtrade more aggressively under the sway of emotional factors.
The researchers also looked at how this sentiment-driven overtrading plays out differently in bull versus bear markets. Their analysis shows that the influence of investor sentiment is much stronger during bull markets, when the collective optimism seems to really fuel excessive trading behaviors.
Definitely, the paper paints a picture of investors, both individual and institutional, getting swept up in the hype and momentum of rising markets, unable to resist the urge to constantly buy and sell in pursuit of quick profits. But when the market turns bearish, that emotional influence seems to wane.
And interestingly, the study also found differences in how investor sentiment impacts overtrading across stocks of different market capitalizations. The effect was strongest for large cap stocks, suggesting that most investors gravitate towards the perceived safety and stability of big name companies when sentiment is running high.
That's a really insightful finding. It implies that the emotional biases of investors can have an outsized impact on the trading activity and price movements of the most heavily traded and influential stocks in the market.
Absolutely, this research really gets to the heart of the interplay between psychology, information, and market dynamics. By focusing on high-frequency, intraday trading patterns, the authors are able to capture the immediate, visceral reactions of investors to shifts in online sentiment.
It's a great example of how behavioral finance can shed light on the irrational undercurrents that can sometimes overwhelm the rational, efficient functioning of financial markets. The fact that even professional, institutional investors seem susceptible to these sentiment-driven biases is an eye-opening finding.
Definitely. And the implications go beyond just academic interest. This research could inform how regulators and market participants try to manage and mitigate the risks of excessive, sentiment-fueled trading activity. Identifying these psychological pitfalls is the first step towards developing more robust, stable financial systems.
Absolutely. This study really challenges the traditional view of markets as perfectly efficient, rational arenas. Instead, it highlights the very human element of investing, where our emotions and biases can lead us astray, even when we think we're being objective.
Well said. This has been a fascinating dive into the nuances of investor psychology and its impact on market microstructure. I'm sure our listeners are walking away with a much richer understanding of how sentiment can drive irrational trading behaviors, even among the professionals.
Definitely. It's a great reminder that markets are driven by people, not just numbers. Understanding that human element is crucial for navigating the ups and downs. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on the Research Rundown.
Bye everyone.
Are you tired of your emotions getting the better of you when investing?
Sick of letting social media sentiment dictate your trading decisions?
Introducing Sentiment Scrubber, the revolutionary AI that filters out the emotional noise and gives you the cold, hard facts.
Sentiment Scrubber uses advanced natural language processing to analyze online chatter and extract the objective, unemotional data you need to make smart, rational investment choices.
Never again will you fall victim to fear, greed, or the latest meme stock frenzy. Sentiment Scrubber keeps your portfolio pure and pristine.
It's like having a behavioral finance PhD advisor in your pocket. Sentiment Scrubber, the antidote to investor psychology gone wild.
Get Sentiment Scrubber now for the introductory price of 3 easy payments of $19.95. Call 1-800-NO-FOMO to order.
Operators are standing by. Sentiment scrubber. Trade with your head, not your heart.